everyone says that they need more housing, they need more affordable housing, but then they, you know, have policies that are antithetical to housing.
Can the Matsu's rapid pace building new homes offer lessons for Anchorage? From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 28th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a school district in Western Alaska builds its own curriculum around language arts and reading.
We want them to see themselves in their literature. Once you do that, it becomes more engaging.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. Two more victims of last week's fatal plane crash in southwest Alaska have been identified. The charter plane owned by Security Aviation crashed near a military radar site on Cape Newenham, killing all eight people on board. Joseph Joe Palmer and Tom Fisher were passengers on the flight and worked for Calista Bryce, a subsidiary of Calista Corporation that represents Alaska Native shareholders from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region. The company shared their names publicly today. Palmer was a project manager with Bryce Builders, and Fisher was a mechanical program manager with Bryce Services, according to the company. Palmer's wife Heidi said in a remembrance post that her late husband prioritized his family and loved riding a snow machine, boating, and fishing. He lived in Wasilla, according to a Facebook post shared by his mother. Fisher was also a family man who lived in Fairbanks and enjoyed Alaska's outdoors, according to his wife, Chris. She said Fisher was also a business owner and a hockey coach who believed in giving back. Earlier this week, the military identified three other victims of the crash. They were fire protection engineer Sabrina Hansen, mechanical engineer Hayden Scalise, and Leah Borsich, a 23-year-old second lieutenant with the U.S. Air Force. Anchorage-based Yukon Fire Protection Services said earlier this week that their employee Trevor McWilliams had also died in the crash. The flight also had two security aviation pilots. Alaska State Troopers and the company had not named them as of today. The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating the crash and expects a preliminary report within a month. A teenager faces 14 felony criminal counts, including three charges of attempted murder, after he allegedly opened fire at police officers in Klawak on the western side of Prince of Wales Island. The officers with the Klawak Police Department responded to a home on South Summit Street Monday night to reports of a disturbance involving a juvenile. Police say they were attempting to speak with family members in the living room when a 17-year-old came out of a bedroom with a rifle and fired at an officer. The officer was uninjured and evacuated the other residents of the home. Alaska State Troopers were called to assist and say the teen continued shooting at officers from inside the home. Police and troopers say they attempted to talk him into exiting the home unarmed, but he refused and continued to threaten them. Troopers say they deployed chemicals into the home and the teen surrendered. No injuries were reported. The teen was booked at the Craig Jail and the case has since been transferred to the Division of Juvenile Justice in Juneau. The next court hearing in the case is set for September 4th at the Prince of Wales Courthouse. A public defender assigned to the case was not immediately available for inquiries. Affordable housing is in short supply nearly everywhere in Alaska, but when it comes to new home construction, one part of the state is leaps and bounds ahead of everywhere else. That's the Matsu Borough. But next door in Anchorage, home construction is slow. So what's the difference? As Alaska Public Media's Hannah Floor found out, there are many reasons, and some of them depend on who you ask.
An hour north of Anchorage, Max Sumner pulls his pickup into a brand new subdivision.
That's North Village, and then on the right side here is South Village.
Sumner is a developer in Wasilla. This isn't one of his projects, but he's been watching it go up. He says most of the houses in South Village are already occupied just a couple years after developers broke ground.
It's pretty fast. I mean, go ask an Anchorage developer how long it would take to create a 40-lot subdivision.
People are moving to the Matsu faster than anywhere else in the state, and homes are going up all over the place to accommodate them. In neighboring Anchorage, a housing shortage prompted the mayor to pledge to bring 10,000 homes onto the market in the next decade. But state data shows that Matsu builds more than three times as many homes as Anchorage each year. So why is construction so much faster in the Matsu? Turns out there are a bunch of reasons. Some of them everyone agrees on. Bob Dole heads Anchorage's Community and Economic Development Department. He says the main reason is there's just a shortage of good land to build on in Anchorage.
It's in smaller parcels than many would like to live on or develop, or it's too steep, or it has drainage issues.
Part of that has to do with the ground. Anchorage has bad dirt, often swampy and silty. Matsu has enviable gravel, which makes it cheaper and easier to build. And Dole says development often doesn't pencil out in Anchorage because the land is more expensive. He says that's because the city is home to many of the major employers in the region, and typically the closer a property is to jobs, the more expensive it is. And then there's the issue of regulations. In Anchorage, builders have to follow a lot of rules, much of it in line with international building code. Developers need to get permits and have their work inspected. But for most of the Matsu, there are far fewer regulations when it comes to building. And this is where people start to disagree. Dole doesn't think the regulations have much of an impact on housing availability. He says the rules are important. They keep people safe.
We make sure your house isn't going to fall apart in an earthquake. We look at snow load. We look at winds. And those standards there, the people of Anchorage have decided they prefer them. And frankly, I do too, living here.
But Matsu developer Max Sumner says homes in the Matsu are well built. He says that's because developers know that nobody is going to be able to get a loan to buy the house if it's not built to international standards.
Everyone says that they need more housing, they need more affordable housing, but then they, you know, have policies that are antithetical to housing.
Sumner says the lack of regulations in the Matsu means houses can go up fast. Someone pays him to build a house, he can start tomorrow. Time is money in construction, he says, and regulations in Anchorage just make things more expensive.
Like the entire building department, if you just got rid of that entire building department, you know, what would be worse off?
Anchorage developer Andre Spinelli says that's a little extreme. Spinelli has been in the industry for decades and is chair of the Anchorage Planning and Zoning Commission. He says he is in favor of regulation, but the problem is municipal permits and inspections can take forever.
How much time are we wasting collectively on this same nonsense?
The nonsense he's talking about are what he says are endless delays because planning department employees don't agree on code or don't understand code or don't properly explain their complaints to developers.
It's like a seven-headed snake where no matter, like, you got to get pretty active to beat it back because every time you cut one thing back, a new thing pops up.
There have been improvements lately, he says. At least city policymakers and officials are all working in the same direction. Bob Dole with the city says, sure, they have ups and downs in the permitting office, but the current staff are some of the best they've ever had. In fact, he says things are going so well that he just got a congratulatory email from none other than Andre Spinelli.
The text of it says, wow, these permits were submitted on Monday and issued today for three houses, i.e. 2 days later.
Spinelli says, yes, he was indeed thrilled. But most permits do not come in 2 days. They come in 20 or 40, even 60 days. It's proof the department can do it, he says. It just doesn't happen very often. In Anchorage, I'm Hannah Floor.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Petersburg students get a hands-on lesson in how to stop invasive species.
It feels like an opportunity to actually prevent it before it spreads and there's the point of no return.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Agencies responding to an oily sheen reported in Cook Inlet earlier this week are switching from response to monitoring mode. Joint Command announced the transition Thursday after going several days without seeing any sheen in the area. The command includes the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, the U.S. Coast Guard, and Hillcorp Alaska, which owns a decommissioned oil platform near where the sheen was seen. On Tuesday, the state said Hillcorp would inspect and test pipes and hoses in the area and repressurize shut-in lines, a common practice in oil spill responses. The state said the oil response ship would remain in the area while that testing happened. In the Thursday update, the command says crews conducted grid searches, flyovers, and surface monitors and did not see any oil. Hillcorp also investigated its spark platform, which was decommissioned in the 1990s and did not find a potential source of the sheen. The command says it will continue investigating the source and nature of the initial sheen reported Monday, with flyovers continuing as appropriate. The state says a pilot flying over the area Monday reported seeing a miles-long sheen in North Trading Bay, about 30 miles northwest of Kenai. The U.S. Coast Guard responded along with Hilcorp and an oil response ship deployed by the Alaska Response Corporation. Lawmakers and military and industry leaders gathered in Fairbanks this week to talk about what Alaska needs to support a growing military presence. It was part of the Alaska Defense Forum, an annual conference focused on military interest in the Arctic. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski was the event's keynote speaker. She said most have gotten the message that Alaska is one of the most strategically important places in the world, but it's important that everyone reach a common understanding of the work ahead.
And here's the hard truth, folks. Alaska's not ready yet. We're still a young state. In many places, we still are building infrastructure for the first time.
Murkowski said she and her colleagues are working to support military readiness by securing federal funding for new ports, harbors, roads, bridges, and sewer systems in Alaska. But Murkowski's main concern is whether the state can generate the power to support that growth. Fairbanks, which neighbors several major military installations, has some of the highest utility costs in the United States, running about 113% above the national urban average.
And we don't have that gas line feeding us down, and we have Cook Inlet that is on the decline. And with our military and our investments, that demand is just going up.
U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan also gave a virtual address at the forum, and Representative Nick Begich sent in a pre-taped message. Well, in 2024, the Bering Strait School District decided its English language arts curriculum was not working for its students and that new off-the-shelf options were expensive and hard for the kids to relate to. So the district chose a different route, build a new curriculum itself. It launched last school year, and early signs indicate it's making a positive impact. KNOM's Margaret Sutherland has the story.
Lori Maynesik graduated from White Mountain School this spring. For most of her middle and high school career, she read excerpts from thick, Springboard-branded textbooks, part of a system sold nationwide and adopted by the district roughly a decade ago.
I just got tired of reading, like, a couple pages of a story instead of, like, an entire book where you can get, like, the entire, story, I guess.
Nessick's English teacher, Joanne Wassley, taught in White Mountain for more than a decade before leaving the district this spring. She didn't like it either.
You very rarely got to see a whole piece. I think they're trying to cover as much as they could in the text for that year, which really was doing a disservice because then you don't get behind what the author's purpose was. You can't really get to the whole meaning of what they wanted you to get out of it.
Curriculums, which are a structured set of lessons, reading materials, and education goals, often come in the form of large textbooks that are sold in bulk to districts across the country. In 2024, the Bering Strait School District, which serves 15 communities across the Seward Peninsula and Norton Sound region, started a review process for their middle and high school English language arts curriculum. Matt Roche, a parent in Unalakleet, served on the review committee.
There wasn't a whole lot of enthusiasm across the board for any of the materials that we reviewed.
Roche says the committee wanted a program that was rigorous, adaptable to different literacy levels, and engaging for students.
My children don't love reading. They're never going to learn how to write a good sentence and critically analyze a piece of text if they haven't first learned how to enjoy reading.
Alex Roberts is the district's director of curriculum and instruction. He was hearing that from parents and academics.
A lot of the research points towards finding really good books and really good stories, and independent reading those stories helps increase the students' enjoyment of reading in general.
Roberts, who is originally from South Carolina, moved to Unalakleet to join the district about 3 years ago. He says the old material often focused on experiences far removed from the lives of students in rural Alaska, like kids living in cities doing city kid things.
We want them to see themselves in their literature. Once you do that, it becomes more engaging. And that's backed by data and educational research.
The district scrapped the search. Over the next year and a half, Roberts spearheaded creating 7 grade levels of curriculum, each with 5 units. It's built around complete books that include local, state, and native authors' stories and perspectives. Budget cuts, he says, left him as the primary administrator working on the project.
It was definitely a labor of love. working nights, working weekends, working all summer, you know, off contract, and getting lots of feedback and not doing it alone.
Lori Nesick noticed the difference in her final year at White Mountain School. English is not her favorite subject, but
I really liked the curriculum this year, actually, compared to like the years prior, because I'm reading those little prompts in the Springboard books were kind of boring.
Nesick's senior class read 5 full-length books. There were classics like Shakespeare's Macbeth and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, but also the 2011 novel The Raven's Gift, written by Southwest Alaska author Don Reardon, about a couple that moves to teach in a Yupik village on the Alaska tundra. In an end-of-the-year curriculum report, other students echoed Nesick.
I was so happy to hear that kids were engaging with stories and really enjoying what they're doing, and the teachers were seeing a difference.
That's Roberts again.
And then we saw the scores go up.
State test scores from the end of last year are not yet available, but BSSD says it has separate early data showing middle and high school literacy rates up 10 percentile points. Former teacher Joanne Wasley says the curriculum was one of several factors that led the school to celebrate rising language arts test scores at graduation.
But the curriculum material coming along when it did was good as well.
She says there's room for more input from the community and teachers. Unalakleet parent Matt Roche also sees the curriculum as a starting point. He'd like it to be tailored even more locally.
We have so many different sites with so many different histories and so many different relationships to the schools. And so I think having a little bit more flexibility is a good first step to addressing the fact that what students in Stebbins need is different than what students in Unalakleet need, which is different than what students in Teller might need.
Robert says he welcomes teachers' feedback.
The idea is that this is a growing and living set of documents that will hopefully guide our reading initiatives for 10, 20 years.
For now, it's year 2 of the new curriculum at BSSD, where titles like Gary Paulsen's Hatchet and George Orwell's Animal Farm await returning students. Reporting in Nome, I'm Margaret Sutherland.
There are more than 2,500 short-term rentals registered in Anchorage, according to newly released data. The city's data on short-term rentals, like those advertised on sites like Airbnb and Vrbo, comes after the Anchorage Assembly in December passed an ordinance requiring that they be registered. Assembly member Zach Johnson sponsored the ordinance and says the registry will help inform future regulations while also giving insight into the impacts they have.
On one hand, there are those of us who believe short-term rentals are having an impact in our community, that, you know, it does have an effect on the housing market. But at the same time, you know, we also want to balance that against, you know, people's right to do as they please with their property.
Based on the registration data, many short-term rentals are in Girdwood, home to Alyeska Resort, as well as in the city's South Addition neighborhood just south of downtown. About 18% of the short-term rentals are located in Girdwood. Nolan Clauda is a policy advisor for Mayor Suzanne LaFrance. He says that the data confirms some of their early assumptions, but there are still things to learn from it.
I think that, we, you know, you look at the situation differently when it's somebody needs to rent out a room in order to afford their home, and versus somebody who's maybe owns multiple properties and, you know, is making a business out of it. I think those are some of the things that we can distinguish, I think, with this information.
The December ordinance came with the possibility of fines for owners who do not register their short-term rentals, but the Assembly has since extended a grace period for the fines. Owners have 30 days after receiving a violation notice to register their rentals before being fined. The grace period ends October 1st. The short-term rental registration is free, and a link to do so can be found on the city's website, muni.org. For the past decade, it's been one man's mission to go to every National Park System site across the country, and he just crossed off number 400 from his list. Pete Selleck visited Sitka National Historical Park on Thursday to continue his quest to see all 433 sites. These places fall under an array of designations: parks, monuments, seashores, and battlefields, to name a few. Most of the destinations Selleck has yet to visit are in Alaska.
As you can imagine, logistically, it's a challenge to get to all these places, to, you know, get the weather just right and get the outfitters that can fly you to the right places at the right time.
The National Park Service has added 16 sites since Selleck started chipping away at the long list. He says this journey is a way for him to marvel at the country's scenery and reflect on its complicated history.
We made some mistakes, but at the same time, we have been trying to become a more perfect union, as we stated in the Constitution. You know, we've been trying to improve as time has gone on. And I think we've overcome a lot of things. We still have a long ways to go. But it does make me appreciate even more the opportunities that we all have being Americans.
Selleck's next stop is Glacier Bay, which will count for two. It's a national park and a national preserve. Though that will help him reach his ultimate goal, he says he would not mind a change of pace.
I'm kind of slowing down a little bit because I've really had a good time doing all this, and I'm going to miss the trips that I've taken with my brother, who's been one of my co-travelers, and my wife.
Selleck might be nearing the end of his list, but his travels are far from over. He and his wife plan to take their two oldest granddaughters to Yellowstone next year. He hopes their trip to the nation's oldest national park will spark the same wonder for the next generation. Petersburg hosted its first ever BioBlitz last month. A scientist from the Smithsonian came to town to show residents how to identify invasive species in the harbor and how to stop them. KFSK's Baze Hohen reports.
Can you help me find a big piece of kelp that's kind of near the surface?
Lyndon McCann darts around the docks in Petersburg South Harbor, turning over buoys and pulling up long fronds of bull kelp.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I want.
She's a marine ecologist for the Smithsonian Invasive Research Lab, and she's on the hunt for a very specific creature.
So they're all marine invertebrates that settle on hard surfaces and often are transported by ships.
They're called tunicates, also known as sea squirts. They're squishy, exoskeletal, potato-shaped organisms that are typically several inches long. But the ones McCann is looking for are not native to Southeast Alaska and can cause problems.
It clogs water intakes and costs a lot of money to keep all this structure clear and unclogged. And it also is ecologically damaging to the local fauna.
Over a dozen locals, including middle schoolers from Petersburg Summer Science Camp, are here helping McCann with what she calls a bio-blitz.
Bio as in biology or animals, and blitz as in rapid. So it's a rapid survey for animals.
In Petersburg, a group follows McCann with buckets as they search the harbor for signs of tunicates and other unwelcome visitors. McCann and the Smithsonian have conducted bioblitzes in communities across Alaska, such as Sitka and Dutch Harbor. Invasive species from down south have been finding a home on Alaska's coast in recent years as seawaters warm. That's according to research conducted by the Smithsonian. But some communities are trying to get ahead of the problem while they still can, like Petersburg. The bioblitzers start looking for collecting plates. They're slabs of square concrete attached to ropes that sink into the water so marine animals can grow on them. Every summer, in partnership with the Smithsonian, students from Petersburg High School install the collecting plates around the harbor.
We put these plates out at a meter's depth, leave them out during the growing season for 3 months, and then we bring them in and take photographs and look at everything that has settled.
McCann pulls the plates out of the water, turns them over, and...
No tunicates.
No tunicates. Finally, McCann finds something she thinks could be invasive on an old boat line.
Oh, that's what I thought it was. We got our first tunicate, guys!
So she scrapes it off the line, sticks it in a Tupperware filled with seawater, and then they're off to check it out. The group inspects their specimens inside a makeshift lab at the local community center. McCann puts her sample under a microscope.
I don't think this is a non-native.
In other words, not invasive. Standing by her is Sunny Rice, the local representative for the Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program, which helps to educate coastal communities on marine conservation. Rice also runs the summer science camp and says it's important to do this work in Petersburg.
It feels like an opportunity to actually prevent it before it spreads and there's the point of no return. We don't have that many intact ecosystems around, and Alaska has a lot of them, so I guess it's our job to do what we can to keep them.
And when the invasive species do arrive, is there a point where you give up? McCann's got an easy answer to that question.
I don't think we ever give up. What we switch to is management. So managing the problem, knowing it's not going away, but trying to contain it.
The group came back with no invasive species this time. For now, Petersburg's waters are safe. If you spot an animal that looks invasive, you can report it to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. In Petersburg, I'm Baze Hohen.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Aliona Niden, Hannah Floor, and Michaela Finnerty in Anchorage, Hunter Morrison in Ketchikan, Ashlyn O'Hara in Soldotna, Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks, Margaret Sutherland in Nome, Lauren Salemo in Sitka, and Baze Hohen in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde, Kirsten Dobroth is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.